Wow, this time I'm kind of scared. I think Mark and I might actually have to behave this week. We have a bishop. We don't have just a bishop. We've got the bishop. We've got a big cheese bishop, and we're looking forward to the conversation. This is a continuation of our conversations about what's going on in the greater United Methodist Church. Stay tuned. I know you're going to want to listen to every bit of this one. You know, the United Methodist Church is full of all kinds of acronyms and good things like that. You know, we've got the UMC, we've got the SEJ, we've got all those good things. And jurisdictional conference, not a word that rolls off the tongue. You know, it's something that we insiders in the United Methodist Church love to talk about, love to scheme about, but, you know, I don't know if it's really something that everybody really understands or wants to understand particularly. Today we're going to get really a very big kind of, you know, 30,000 foot level conversation about what's going on in the greater church, especially right after we just got through with a round of jurisdictional conferences. Now, these meetings they're meetings. We love meetings, but hey,
they're important,
and things happen. So, Mark just got back from one, didn't you, Mark?
Oh, my goodness. Meeting is the word, you know. 8 a.m., things kick off with worship until about 8:30 at night. And way more praying than you would ever imagine is possible. Before every vote, for every report, we pray. Jesus is called upon.
Well, I would hope so, right?
Yeah,
I wonder sometimes about...
It's one of the few times in my life that I actually look up and think, good night, do we have to pray again?
I've always wondered about the Council of Nicaea, or, you know, some of the meetings where, you know, the creeds were come up with. And we don't even think about it, but the Bible itself was put together by a committee. You know, and was there, did they pray as much as you guys did?
I feel confident in saying the Council of Nicaea did not pray as much as we did at Southeastern Jurisdiction.
Oh, good. Okay. Well, I feel better now.
Glad that's comforting.
Yeah. Because when it's bathed in prayer, that's never, ever a bad thing.
And that's true. That's true.
So, yeah. So what's going on? What's going on at the church these days, Mark?
Okay, so there's two things I want to clarify for people who are connected to our church here. First United Methodist Church in Oak Ridge.
Because we know that people from around the world are going to be listening to this.
Well,
you know?
And they should.
But it's actually a podcast produced by a local church.
Exactly, so. And in our local church, we're getting ready to do something that is actually quite rare in the southeastern part of the United States. We're voting to join the Reconciling Ministries Network. That vote is going to take place on Sunday mornings beginning November 20th. Bishop Ken Carter coming to preach for us that day. He's kind of our bishop in residence. And that's when it's going to kick off. He'll be preaching in the traditional services. You can vote if you were here present with us in person, or you can vote virtually by joining the live stream. And that'll be for 3 weeks. People have an opportunity to vote. So
that's big. Bishop Carter, let's just talk for a second. He was my pastor when I was transitioning into seminary, right?
Right.
And you know what? He advised me that the best school that I could go to was Candler School of Theology. And I did. I took his advice.
Duke Divinity School mug that I have here. Bishop,
it's too bad this is an audio. It's too bad this is an audio-only podcast, but
people feel the holiness attached to that. They know. So,
all right.
Moving on. I want to clarify something. We have, as you know, most everybody knows, we have every Wednesday a community meal that feeds about 180 people. For Thanksgiving, they would like pies to help give each family not only a meal but a pie to take home. That's different from our Thanksgiving shop that will be taking place. The Thanksgiving shop, we're going to serve 60 different families who have been sent to us through the United Way, But that food is already covered. The pies are already covered. So you can bring pies for the community meal next week, Monday through Wednesday. That would be great. And, hey, if you want to contribute some money to the Thanksgiving shop, that would be wonderful. But two different things, two different food ministries, and both of those.
Both involving pie.
Both involving everything should have a pie attached to it.
So. Yeah. What's your favorite pie, Mark?
Oatmeal. Oatmeal pie. My grandmother used to make oatmeal pie. Imagine a warm oatmeal cookie coming out of the oven.
Oh, okay.
That
I can
is
relate
oatmeal
to that.
Pie. It's
I can relate to that.
Fantastic. And my wife makes a kicking oatmeal pie. So, just saying out loud. Well, I guess it's time to move on to more serious matters.
No, never.
Oh.
Why do you say that?
Because okay. I'm excited. I'm really
yeah,
ready
we're excited.
To. I want to welcome to Can the Church Be Saved, Bishop Thomas Bickerton. He was born, raised, and ordained in West, by God, Virginia. He, wise man that he was, went to Duke University, the divinity school. He also got a D.Min from United Theological Seminary. He is currently the bishop of the New York Episcopal area. For those of you in the Southeast, that is the annual conference that covers Western Connecticut, all of Long Island, all the boroughs of New York City, and areas on both sides of the Hudson going north. That, quite frankly, is the most important part of his vita because he doesn't even know it yet. But my wife, who's also a United Methodist pastor, was born in Oyster Bay, Long Island, in a parsonage. Her grandfather, Nicola Notar, served as an Italian home missionary in Harlem. Her father, Bob Notar, was in the New York Annual Conference. She's a pastor. I'm a pastor. It's great to see a bishop that's out of her tradition, out of her legacy.
Yeah, I think the reason Mark is really keen on saying all this is because he wants you to pick up on the fact that Annette wants an appointment under your leadership.
And we are ready to receive her with open arms.
Mission accomplished. Well, this has been great. This has been a great conversation. Thank you all for listening.
Mark, did she go to Duke?
She did indeed.
Well, there's a slam dunk.
There you go. See, I love that.
This could be the farewell podcast because I've got a clergy couple coming to New York.
Excellent. We will hold you to that. Well, I really do want to say thank you for joining us. It is a busy time of year. Southeastern jurisdiction just met. I attended that. Northeastern jurisdiction just met. They all meet simultaneous.
That's right.
For those who aren't knee-deep in the United Methodist Connection, there's a lot of business that actually happens at jurisdictional conferences, more than people realize. There's five in the United States. But the primary issue that garners almost all of the attention is election of bishops. So we just want to say thank you for joining us at this point and glad you're here.
Thanks. I really appreciate it. I was honored for the invitation and happy to join any of these podcasts to give further insight and have great conversation like this. You called me the big cheese, and I hope I'm a big hunk of Swiss or cheddar, not Lindberger. So I'm hoping that this is going to be a good, cheesy conversation.
How about Emmentaler? Would that be appropriate?
I'm from West Virginia. I don't understand that language.
Well, we always begin all the interviews, whether it's someone who's a denominational leader or a local ministry person here, asking the same question, the name of the podcast, Can the Church Be Saved? And that gives insight, how they answer that gives us real insight into what that person's perspective on ministry and the greater church is. So I'd love for you to just begin there. When you hear that question, Can the Church Be Saved? What comes to mind?
The answer is yes. Unequivocally, yes, as long as we keep Christ at the center of everything that we do. It's not about us. It's not about our agenda. It's not about saving the church as an institution or saving the church as a building or as stained glass windows or padded pews. It's about saving the gospel and integrating that gospel into mission and ministry in the context in which we serve. Can the church be saved? Absolutely, as long as we continue to follow the direction of Christ our Lord.
Amen. I love that answer. And I love how you you touched on a really important issue coming out of all the different jurisdictional conferences. If we can do it in context, at every single jurisdictional conference, there were three resolutions that were passed. One of those had to do with supporting the Christmas covenant. This is a measure, basically, for those who haven't read it, that would allow different regions of the United Methodist Church, the United States, Southeast Asia, Africa, Europe, to all take the Book of Discipline, take the guidelines of what it means to be in Methodist, and then to make it contextualized for our own situation. That regionalization is a really key part of what, beyond electing bishops, but that was a really key part of what we did. Now, in Southeast, that brought, not surprisingly, because in the Southeast, everything's controversial when it comes to the church and racism and all that goes with that. I'm curious, how was that received in the Northeast?
Very well. And, you know, I just have to say, I think we sometimes think that we're so innovative, and when in fact, if you look back, this has been something we've always been a part of. I mean, take a look at why Methodism thrived in the United States when it first came here. It thrived because John Wesley had to adapt to a regional context. The plea from Methodists in the United States was for Wesley to ordain clergy to come to the United States so that they could perform and receive the sacraments. Wesley didn't like the idea. He wasn't too keen on ordaining pastors because it was going to separate himself from the church that he wanted to be a part of, namely the Anglican Church. John Wesley passed the Christmas Covenant in the late 1700s by appointing Francis Asbury and Thomas Coke to come here to start the Methodist movement in the context of the Revolutionary, post-Revolutionary War. That, by the way, didn't really like England so very much. So what we think is innovative is not innovative at all. It's just a revisiting of how to make Methodism relevant for the 21st century. And that is, quite frankly, that for us to think from a colonial standpoint, that the way we do things in the United States is the way they do it in the Philippines and Africa and Europe is pretty presumptuous on our part. And for us to think that ministry in the Southeast, South Central, West, North Central, and Northeast regions of the United States can or should be done the same way is just as naive.
And it's fascinating, isn't it? That, I mean, I can't agree with you more. It goes back to Paul's statement, I am all things to all people. I become what is necessary to reach people with Christ. It's the biblical message.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think to think otherwise is to limit the gospel. The gospel is so powerful that it can be contextually adapted and still reach people for Christ. I mean, you know, it's really quite interesting to me, having been born and raised in West Virginia, that I'm now the bishop of New York City. And, you know, and I'll tell you, there are things that are transferable and there are things that are not. And I've had to adapt my leadership to changing contexts and to understand that if we're going to reach people for Christ in New York City, it's going to be, the gospel is the same, but the mechanism by which the gospel is transmitted is different, as it should be.
As it should be. And what's really ironic is we just are talking about being at jurisdictional conferences. The history of why we have jurisdictional conferences is because post-Civil War, we believe so deeply in regionalism and contextual nature of ministry and trying to, well, just be honest, it's a racist background where people in the Southeast weren't thrilled with the idea of people in other parts of the country electing bishops that would be hoisted upon them. Our own history of jurisdictionalism comes out of that regionalism, that belief in contextualism. That's the best way of saying it. The more probably authentic way is based out of racism. And racism was another one of those huge topics in jurisdictional conferences.
Well, if you study the events of 1939, and there are a lot of takeaways from that general conference in 1939, The whole idea of jurisdictions was a good idea until it was perverted by the insertion of the central jurisdiction, which isolated people of color into their own jurisdiction. And so it really was, the jurisdictions were born out of racism. It didn't have to be that way, because I think the good thinking about regionalism just simply got perverted by the racist tendencies and really the inappropriate compromises that took place in order for union to happen. And I think that's one of the real learnings, is that, you know, we're called to guard the unity of the church, but not with injustices. And that's really what happened in 39. We could do a whole podcast on the 1939 General Conference, because I've been doing a lot of research on 1939 as a way of informing my own leadership today. But you're absolutely right. In its purest essence, the jurisdictional conferences were intended to be very honoring of contextual expressions of ministry.
Yeah, I when I was at Candler School of Theology, we had Bishop Nolan Harmon. Did you ever meet Bishop Harmon?
I did. I have a story about that.
I bet you do. But he would always talk. He was he was a bishop who was, I think he was in his 90s while he was still teaching.
Mm-hmm. He was.
And he was this wealth of knowledge about things that had taken place in the church. And he would always stand in front of the class and talk about the merger. But he wasn't talking about the merger in 1968. He was talking about the merger that you're talking about.
That's right.
Yeah,
that's
incredible.
Exactly right.
In other words, it's not that far away in history, right?
Yeah, and I don't want to co-opt our time, but I just said I've been spending a lot of time researching 1939 and general conferences prior to that. You guys might know this, but from 1784 to 1939, the Book of Discipline was really a spiritual rule book. It was chock full of ways to hold each other accountable, ways to hold yourself accountable, the conduct of a pastor, the conduct of laity. I always kid with my pastors, and I'm sure that they have a current copy of the Book of Discipline sitting on their nightstand, and they read a chapter before they go to sleep at night. But really, prior to 1939, they did. I have my copy of the 1860 Book of Discipline is signed by a layperson who signed his name, and underneath it wrote, "This is my book." And those disciplines stated very clearly that the first order of business for a Methodist Christian was to know the scriptures. The second was to know the Book of Discipline. And there's a section in every single one of those disciplines from 1784 to 1939 that talk about essentials for unity. And they're all spiritually driven. In 1939, they took all that stuff out. Every bit of it.
Wow.
And in 1939, with the advent of the jurisdictions and the racist motivations to form them, that was only one thing that happened. In 1939, we became institutionalized. We became academic. Nothing wrong with academics, but we became overly academic. Methodism admitted at that point that it was no longer a frontier movement, but it was a settled institution. And we've had problems ever since, quite frankly, and we need to reinstitute it. My Nolan Harmon story, by the way, I was president of the student body at Duke in 1982 and 1983. Nolan Harmon came to Duke Divinity School, and I had a chance to be a liturgist when he was speaking. And he was a man of small stature, and I swear to you guys, his hands were translucent. You could almost see through his hands. And I remember shaking hands with Bishop Nolan Harmon, thinking, I have just crushed this poor man's hands in my grip.
Exaggerating.
I am dealing with, here it is 40 years later, and I'm still dealing with the guilt of nearly crushing a bishop's hand in my handshake.
I love that. You know, we just yesterday we hosted a someone speaking on hymnody, a professor at the University of Tennessee, and he pointed out, and he was talking about the hymn, those four different versions of the hymnal in the 20th century, and he pointed out something I never realized, that even during the split, when there was a Methodist Episcopal Church and Methodist Episcopal Church South, that they cooperated on the hymnal that came out together. I thought that was a wonderful statement of exactly what we're talking about in terms of the ability. I mean, it's contextualization, right? We can recognize that we're in two different, radically different, separated for, you know, in many painful ways, and yet still work together on things that matter to us. And when we talk about the Christmas covenant that's going to be coming up at General Conference, the idea of contextualization, that's a really important idea to hold on to, that it is our past as well.
Yeah, I think there's, I've always, I appreciated, you guys probably know the name Jim Harnish. I always appreciated a book that Jim Harnish wrote, and one of the chapters was, and I'm paraphrasing, one of the chapters was, thank goodness windshields are bigger than rearview mirrors. And, you know, and he always said if a rearview mirror was bigger than a windshield, we'd be crashing everywhere we went. So thank goodness windshields are bigger than rearview mirrors, but thank goodness there's a rearview mirror. And we ought to be looking into it, because we don't have to reinvent the wheel. The wheel's already been invented in large measure by our past. We just need to glean from it and adapt it into the modern context. And it saves us a lot of heartache and time if we do that. And it also gives us an insight of how the church got to the point where it is today, in the best sense of the word.
Well, I want to make sure we come back and pick up some of the other resolutions that were passed at all the jurisdictional conferences. But I would love to just hear your overall insight. What trends did you see among all the different elections in the five jurisdictions that you think are important for us to hold up and examine?
Well, I tell you what, fellas, I think that we are at a real crossroads, and we all know that from a negative standpoint. I mean, with disaffiliations, post-COVID fatigue, issues of sustainability that have been around long before COVID ever came, you know, we're really at a crossroads. And I think the jurisdictional conferences really acknowledged something that I've been spending a great deal of time in the Council of Bishops talking about our need to make a pivot. Our conversations are downward conversations. They are conversations that are not so visionary. They're much more triage conversations. How do we get to the point where the dust settles with disaffiliations? How are we going to how are we going to survive sustainability? All that's a downward trending conversation. And I've been talking in the Council of Bishops that we've got to make a pivot. And that gear that makes the pivot, by the way, is very rusted and not functional. So we've got to lubricate it. We've got to massage it. We've got to reframe it. And then we've got to make this pivot back into a conversation about mission and ministry. I looked at the jurisdictional conferences as one of those events that potentially broke the gear open so that the pivot could happen, because in effect we've elected one of, if not the most diverse class of bishops coming into the council. These will be people who will they will be on the ground floor of the next expression of Methodism. And so if we ever needed to get it right, it was this time, because we've elected people who are going to serve anywhere for the next 4 to 25 years in the life of the church. And, you know, I've been a bishop now for 19 years. I still have 6 years to go. And so I understand about what that longevity looks like. I also understand the clear reality that I all of a sudden have blinked my eyes and I'm on the back end. So I'm preparing to pass it on to this next generation of bishops. The Council of Bishops will have a 72% turnover by the end of 2024. And so these are the persons who are going to be at the helm, if you will, in terms of setting the agenda, setting the pace, giving the leadership. for this next expression. And that's the pivot. Mm-hmm. We've got to be involved in a conversation about what God's calling us to next. We cannot be in this posture of, oh, we're just trying to get back to the way we were before COVID. Those days are gone. And I, frankly, when it comes to issues of racism and the church moving forward in terms of full inclusion, I don't want to go back.
Oh, amen.
I want us to move forward. And so I think you've got a class of bishops who are going to, they're going to assume leadership, and I look forward to calling them colleagues. And then, you know, when my time passes, helping to support them to succeed in this next expression of who we are.
I strongly recommend all those who are listening, if you haven't taken the time to go to UM News and look at all the different reports from around the jurisdictions about who were elected as bishops. This is the first time we have our first Native American bishop in the South Central jurisdiction. We have our first Filipino American bishop in the Western jurisdiction. It was the first Hispanic Latino bishop in the Northeast, first Black woman in the South Central jurisdiction, and our first openly gay Black man commissioned as bishop and in the Western jurisdiction. There's a lot of firsts, and as you said, that diversity, it's wonderful. It's just so life-giving to recognize that maybe, Steve and I, we did a podcast that was based out of the Southeastern jurisdiction. And we ended that podcast by having a moment of realizing, you know, we are just, after years of turmoil, years of being all this infighting, we're so close to having an opportunity where we're all focused in the same direction. We're unified again. And how exciting that could be. What could happen if the Methodist Church actually suddenly supported one another and moved in the same direction?
Well, you know, I think there are just clear realities in the midst of it all. And I don't want to be naive about it. You know, we have a group of people, sadly, my heart breaks. We have a group of people, sadly, that are choosing not to be a part of us anymore. Some of those are from on the left. Many of those are on the right. Many of them, and I'm talking to, you know, at least one well-trained seminarian on this call. the other one, that community college down in Atlanta. You know, I'm watching the laughter here.
Yeah, I had my mic turned off. You didn't hear what I really had to say.
I'll tell you, there's actually two well-trained seminarians. My wife's also in the room with me, so she was appreciating that comment.
Fantastic. The Long Islander arrives. Now, what were we talking about? I'm getting old. I lost my train of thought. And by the way, many of those that are, our research reveals that many who are going through disaffiliations are not going to another organized group. They're going independent, and they're in large measure being led by local pastors, which is a real signal that we don't understand Methodism. Independence is not Methodist. Methodism is all about connection. So, you know, the point I'm trying to make is there, if you take an onion and you peel off a couple layers, that's what's happening to us right now. But we dare not be naive, because if people think that what's left is going to be a homogenous denomination, they're going to be greatly disappointed. Yeah. I think the sad thing about losing these folks is that, whether it be on the left or the right, we're losing a part of what it means to be fully inclusive. Inclusivity means the right and the left and the center. It means big tent. And it means, more than anything else, guys, it means learning how to respect diversity of thought. I get really, really tired of people who, in effect, say, if you don't think like I do, I'll just pray for you to come to your senses someday, and you'll come around to what's right. I never want to be so presumptuous as to think I have the right answers. What I want to be a part of is a denomination that says we have great diversity of thought, and we can demonstrate to the world that we love one another in the midst of that diversity. That's our opportunity. But it can't be an opportunity that says my region's thought is better than your region's thought. or my approach in my local church is better than yours. What we have to do is understand that we are, it's not about our local churches, not about our annual conferences, not about our jurisdictions. It really is about the people who drive by our congregations and never find a way inside. It's not about taking care of what we already have. It's about using what we already have to promote this gospel of grace, hope, joy, and love to a very broken world. And we've got to get back to that mission and understand that we need people who are going to sing Amazing Grace as much as we need someone to sing the latest contemporary song that's been mastered by some great contemporary group. We need it all. And that's how we win people to Christ, is to realize that there are different ways to reach different people with the same gospel.
I still think that the church may be the last place around anywhere where people of very, very differing opinions sit next to each other in church and sit next to each other in anywhere. And we're in such a divided society. Enough of my yak. You know, we got to take a break here. We got to pay
talking,
the bills.
We're talking at each other rather than talking with one another. And that's the whole essence.
Indeed. And I'm going to talk at all of us right now, because Bishop Bickerton, this is the favorite part of the podcast. People don't listen to this podcast because of, the conversations. It's because of the sponsors that we have. We have very, very good sponsors. And today, our sponsor is, let's just let it roll, okay? Can the Church Be Saved is brought to you today by the wisdom of your grandparents. It doesn't matter if you are 10 or 110 years old, your grandparents shared with you the same words of sage advice and deep understanding that they heard from their own elders.
What's that racket? Your generation's music is awful.
We have compiled a list of common quotes from grandparents across the last 1,000 years. And now their insights can inspire you.
You're gonna go out in public wearing that?
Join those who went before you, all enduring the same biting wit.
The world is going to hell in a handbasket.
Because those same grandparents were the ones who also said,
"You are more and more handsome every time I see you."
And
I can't get over what a beautiful young woman you have become.
The wisdom of your grandparents is available now in Borders bookstores across the world. I mean, I'm buying that for Christmas for everybody. Everybody I know. That's the Christmas gift of the season, I think.
You know what's awful is being a grandparent now and hearing the same stuff come out of my own mouth and realizing I really have become that old curmudgeon. I have now become that grandfather. Shocking.
Yeah, he's got a big sign in his front yard that says, "Get off my lawn, kids." It's amazing. This is the great thing. Mark and I Mark's so much older than I am. He's got 5 grandkids and I've got 0, and that's, Bishop has three.
Yeah.
So
I'm winning. That's what I hear.
You are, in biblical terms, you are a wealthy man.
I have many arrows in my quiver. That's right.
Quiver. Yeah. All right. Enough of the silliness. I hope everybody's been able to get up out of their chairs and, take a walk around and, make a snack, pop a beverage, whatever, because we're coming back at it right now. Yeah. Take it away, Mark.
Bishop, it was really an important key for people to understand that at each of these jurisdictions, we actually elected, I think in most jurisdictions, fewer bishops than we were allowed to by discipline. For exactly the reason you're talking about, the disaffiliations, there's an awareness at the general conference level that we have a certain number of churches who will not be staying with us by the time we get to general conference in 2024 in Charlotte. I know in the Southeast, they talked about they expect 1,300 churches. That's the estimate, 1,300 churches in the Southeast that will be leaving to become independent or part of a different denomination. And that represents a quarter of their budget that they assume is going to be missing. Is that the same? I mean, is the Southeast unique in that? Are we, because we are on the more conservative side of the theological spectrum for the most part, do you have fewer churches percentage-wise in the Northeast or in the Western? I was just curious what you can speak to in terms of what the general population of those leaving are.
Sure. It is very regional, Mark. You know, we know in the Southeast, for example, there are two or three conferences that could lose 50% of the churches, that being in the South Central as well. Early estimates are that we're going to lose 15 to 20% of our churches across the connection. That could be a little higher or less depending on rhetoric, and there is a lot of false narrative out there and how that narrative is really embraced by people who want to talk about it. I really find it very interesting that in local churches where a pastor has the courage to stand up in a pulpit and say, we are not going to talk about this, we're going to be about the mission and ministry of the church, the congregation does not entertain those conversations on the whole about disaffiliating. It really does center on the strength and conviction of the leader. And if there are pastors that are listening on this podcast, I would just say to you, there's great reason for us to be United Methodists. We're not perfect. There isn't a perfect church out there. If you think you're going to create one by being independent, or if you think you're going to create one by going to another denomination that's going to have its imperfections, then I think you're crazy at that point. Sorry to use that word, but I think you're just misguided. We're not a perfect denomination, but I think there's great reason to remain. I'm sorry for my pitch, but
No, that's okay.
I remain in this liminal season. I'm still the president of the United Methodist Committee on Relief. You tell me an independent church or another denomination that's going to, without much solicitation, raise $27 million for Ukrainian relief.
Amen.
You find me another denomination that tomorrow morning, when the after effects of a tropical storm turned hurricane blew through Florida to provide its second major blow, you find another church that's going to be on the scene tomorrow providing, and we just approved in UMCOR $4 million of emergency grants for Ian recovery right on the spot. We'll do it again tomorrow. I will receive a call tomorrow about emergency grants that we'll approve from UMCOR tomorrow. It's the power of the connection. And it's really a great thing for us to think about. However, to your question, I find the human spirit is really interesting. We can understand reality better than we can live into it. And we are creatures of habit. We want to do things the same way. We want to have things the same way. We grow comfortable with those kinds of things. Here's the reality. We're going to be 15, 20, 25% less than what we were. And although many of those churches are small membership churches, it's often the small membership churches that are most faithful to apportionment payout. And you know, the reality is we can't be the same. We're going to be less than what we were. I'm sad about that. I don't want that to happen. If anybody listening to this podcast, I need you to hear from me clearly. I don't want you to leave. I think we're stronger together than apart. But we are going to be less. And that means that we have less resources on the general church level. That's going to affect our general agencies. It's also going to affect our Episcopal fund. And the reality is we're going to have to redraw boundaries. We're going to have to reform the way that the episcopacy is conducted. The role and function of a bishop is going to change. Our territories are going to get bigger. And we've got to figure out how to readjust in a positive way to how we administrate the gospel across the country. And that's why, you know, our General Counsel on Finance and Administration has initiated some preliminary thoughts about how the Episcopal Fund is going to be affected. And we, in effect, in the jurisdictions, reduced the number of bishops by 8 in this jurisdictional conference season. There is some suggestion that we're going to have to do it by approximately a dozen more come 2024. So it is a major change. And I welcome that. I think any obstacle has an adjoining opportunity to it. Amen. And perhaps the episcopacy has grown a little stale, and I believe more diocesan than it should be. And diocesan is that we focus more on the annual conference that I'm assigned to serve, rather than looking at the discipline carefully and realizing that when you're elected a bishop, you're elected a bishop of the whole church. And so we just have to have the courage to reframe and reform how we do our work. I think, you know, I know in the Southeast, for example, I think even your annual conference is a part of a coverage assignment with Bishop Wallace Paget.
It is.
What we found in the Northeast with the coverage assignments is that cabinets are stepping up to the plate and providing more significant leadership. It's enabling lay leadership and clergy leadership to be strengthened. It's not about micromanaging the church with a bishop's leadership. It's about enabling leadership to find their voice. And I think these coverage assignments are revealing to us one of the pleasant surprises about how that can happen if we are willing to reframe the episcopacy.
We in Holston have been so thrilled, even though we were, when we received Bishop Wallace Paget, thinking, oh no, we're going to share her with North Alabama. It's been a breath of fresh air. It's been a wonderful experience. And exactly what you're saying, it increases the responsibility of the district superintendents and lets them step up. We were talking earlier about the changes coming out of 1939. One of those changes was a decrease in the actual power of the Episcopal leaders and the voice that they have, you know, at General Conference, to not have vote, to only have voice. I sense when I am a part of jurisdictional conversations, there's that new energy of kind of everyone saying, you know, things are changing and it's time, and we need to examine all of how we work and how we function and how we organize. I, for one, would love to examine the Episcopal role and say, what do we need in this context, in the modern world, in terms of an episcopacy? What do we need? District superintendents, maybe it's just our conference, but for so long they were handed 1,000 things to do, none of which had to be with being connected to the local church. They had so much administrative tasks handed to them that they had a hard time being in local churches. So I, for one, am all for the reexamination and realigning ourselves with the mission.
I remember, you know, back when I was a pastor, my last local church, I had a parishioner come in my office and say, so-and-so's in the hospital. When are you going to visit him? And my answer was, I'll pick you up right after lunch and we can go together. And that person said, I don't do hospital visits. And I had the courage as a pastor at that moment to say, don't you ever ask me to do something that you're not willing to do yourself. I will pick you up right after lunch. 9 years later, when I went to the hospital, Ransford had already been there or was sitting in the chair when I got there. I had been able to groom him into a sense of calling about how he was in ministry. It's not about what is the bishop going to do. It's about what are we in leadership going to do to enable people to sense their calling on all levels of the church's life. That really is how you grow a church and how you grow a conference. It's not about one person. It's about enabling the call of God to be felt and realized in the people who are in all levels of the church's life.
Yeah. It's I mean, you're speaking to that great dilemma of the professionalization of ministry. We've assumed that, oh, ministry is what the clergy do, not what the people do. And yeah, it's that reexamination again from the bottom up of, we are called to live into the kingdom. We are called to be the people of God. I love that.
It's that rusty gear that has to be freed up so we can make the pivot.
Yeah.
Bishop, I've got a question if I can jump in. This is my right as the, you know, producer of this thing. So I guess I can do what I want. One of my colleagues would shout at me if I didn't ask this question right now, and it has to do with real estate and buildings. When we talk about diminishing size of congregation of congregations, yes, of conferences, and on and on, we're talking about buildings that are either they fall apart. They're not being used at all. They become unusable, or, you know, even more sadly, in a lot of ways, they're buildings that are not full and they're not being used, you know, 7 days a week like other buildings in our world do. As you look at that problem, give us a sense of what that issue really looks like from the level where you sit.
Well, it's a fascinating question, and I could speak, again, an entire podcast on answering that question. It all begins with the fact that Methodism was an entrepreneurial frontier movement. It wasn't something that was organized, although method is a part of Methodism, but it really was an organic expression. We give all the attention to the circuit riders. Circuit riders came into a community, served communion, and they were on the horse going somewhere else. It was the lay persons, especially lay women, because the men back in that day were working the fields, who really organized and grew the church in those local settings. It was about a passion for what the gospel could do to change people's lives. Frankly, our buildings are a commentary on the fact that we probably do a very good job of taking care of the people that we already have and not really focusing on the people that we need to bring into an awareness of what life with God through Jesus Christ can do for them. I'm a big missions person. I've been on dozens of volunteer mission trips. I've worked any number of food pantries, and my mission portfolio speaks for itself. But even that is a little suspect these days, because if there's not an invitation attached to the mission, then we're no different from a secular agency out there. We have to claim our difference, and that is that we integrate grace, hope, justice, joy, and love into everything that we do. And we don't need to have people assume it. We need to tell the story. I tell my pastors frequently, what's your desired outcome in worship? Do you have a desired outcome? If your desired outcome is to get to noon, then I think you got some examination to do. If your desired outcome is to effect a change in someone's life, then you're on the right track. We do a lot of, our conference is highly immersed in discovering what it means to be an anti-racist annual conference. And I tell my annual conference, it's all about conversion. We've got to inject some traditional understandings into the broad change that we desire in our own lives and in our culture. If we're going to become an anti-racist denomination, there has to be a change of heart and attitude in the people that are in the pew. And until that light bulb goes off, we're going to continue to struggle with keeping anti-racism on the front page of our emphasis. It's all about a change of heart. And so what I find in our buildings is a worship of the building, which means we're worshiping the method that was, rather than using those buildings as a mission outpost for the spreading of the gospel. When I make appointments in New York, my pastors know this to a T. I do not appoint one pastor to a local church. I appoint every one of my pastors to a community. and I invite them to use the building as a mission outpost for mission and ministry. I do not
love that. Love that.
So, you know, it's about leadership, guys. It's about what we say, how we say it, how we hold ourselves accountable to it. Accountability is not a harsh word. It's a word that, when injected with grace and love, can really lead us to continue to capture the call that was placed on our hearts whenever it came. You know, I say to my folks in New York all the time, when was the last time that Jesus became more than just a name to you? In other words, to use traditional language, I was saved on June 23rd, 1973, and I've been in the process of being saved every day since. That's Wesleyan sanctification. It's also keeping our call fresh so that these buildings don't become monuments of a past day, but they become really just a vehicle so that the gospel can be proclaimed in mission and ministry.
I love what you're talking about, and it really does go back to what we were talking about before, the reimagining who we are. And I think as an elder in the church, my wife and I are elders, I think it's a reimagining as elders who we are. I think sometimes we've taken that to be a tenure system as opposed to a remembering the ministry to reach out into the community. I love, love, love the idea of you're appointed to a community. I know Annette's grandfather was appointed to the Italians in Harlem. It was to that greater community, and he was a home missionary there. And that's a language we need to recover as elders in the church.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I really resonate with what you said before, Mark, that ministry has become professionalized, and we've done it at certain marker points. One of those marker points, and I mean no disrespect to this group when I say this, one of those significant marker points was 1996, when we professionalized the ministry of the deacon. There was nothing wrong with what we did in 1996, with one exception. We didn't have anything to fill the gap behind it, which is to say, we basically said to the church, if you're not a professional, you can't serve. So what is it about the ministry of the laity that has been lost? You know, we've got droves of people who think this is the job of the pastor, and one of the biggest groups that believe that are the pastors themselves.
When you were saying that earlier, it made me think. Annette had 5 churches in her first appointment. I had 3. That was in very rural part of Virginia. You know what the most important role was in that church? In all those churches, Sunday school superintendent.
Right. I had 6 churches. My first student appointment was 6. So I'd walk in. We had 8:30, 9:30, 11 on one side of the charge, and 7 in the evening on the other. Then the next week we'd flip. So I would go in. When I would go into Indian camp at 9:30, the Sunday school superintendent was running the show.
And they claimed that ministry. They saw it as, this is, I'm a minister in this church. That's that passion we need to recapture.
Absolutely.
This has been great. Thank you. I can't thank you enough for joining us and allowing us to engage in what might be adequate or rightfully called United Methodist Inside Baseball. But you know, it's good to get out there, and it's so amazing to hear your sense of vision for the church. I am most impressed by what seems to have come out of the jurisdictional conferences is a sense of optimism, a sense of hope, mm-hmm. a sense of material hope, not just a kind of a, you know, the hope we've had, which is like, oh wow, it really looks bad, but we hope that
better.
we hope God's gonna do something here, you know. But there is a tangible sense of hope now, and that's really exciting. I really, again, thank you so much for being with us, and wish you the very best. What's next for you? You're in Charlotte right now, right? Is that correct?
Yeah, I'm taking care of the grandkids for the weekend.
Taking care of the grandkids.
You know, it's really interesting, this gig as the Council of Bishops president. It's a lot of responsibilities right now, and in fact, most of my time is spent doing Council of Bishops work at this point. It's probably 70-30, and I've got a great group in New York that's stepping up to the plate in the midst of it all. But, you know, I would just say to you guys that my work is important, the jurisdiction's work is important, the general church's work is important, but what's most important? The ministry of the local church and mobilizing our people for mission and ministry in the name of Christ.
Amen. Amen. Bishop Thomas Bickerton, thank you so much for joining us.
Anytime, guys. Anytime.
Well, folks, that's it. Mark, did we behave? Do you think?
Oh, we were so good. There was
maybe
no
we should
cursing.
Talk. Ask the bishop.
There was
if,
no
if he thinks
beeping
we
out. We didn't no. have
other,
a bleep
other
out.
Than other than a lack of humility. You guys were great.
Perfectly, wonderfully said. Thank you so much. All right, folks. Next week, we don't know who's going to be on this show. We never do, but it's going to be somebody great. Looking first things to make sure that you see how to subscribe to this podcast. Walk around with us in your ears when you go out on a walk in the neighborhood or you go to the gym or just on a commute. You know, we try to make it fresh for you. So spread the word, like and subscribe, all those good things. And, you know, the takeaway, ministry is not, it's not the job of an elite. We know that. It is part of our baptism. We are baptized to serve. And so we all have a place to be part of God's work in this world. And man, it's never been more necessary, I don't think. All right. Peace out. Thank you. Talk to you next week.